Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Charles Mudd on Startup Radio, and I am pleased and excited to have Marcy Capron with us here today. She is founder and CEO of Polymathic and Junto, which she'll explain to us in just a little bit, the relationship between those. But before Polymathic and Junto, she was a freelance photographer and director, as well as a media specialist at Northwestern University's Advanced Media Production Studio. And as anyone in the Chicago area may know, Polymathic, Junto, and Marcy are an exciting part of the Chicago startup culture. So again, I'm excited to have you with us. Welcome to the show, Marcy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let me begin, because the relationship between Polymathic and Junto is an interesting relationship. But to take a step back, why don't we start with what is Polymathic and how did you come to start that media enterprise?
Freaking empire of sorts. Well, I was going to school for photography way back. As I started photography very, very young, I was about 11 years old. I was really into it. I thought my whole life was going to be photography forever and ever. Got to art school, didn't like it so much. Wound up transferring to Northwestern, where I studied film and communications. And then I went to grad school for advertising, kind of a way to marry everything, so video, photography, and media. And that's when I was working at Northwestern, too. And then I started working at an ad agency, and I realized that it wasn't really a good fit for me and that everything was very slow-moving. And I was very lucky to come from this background where my father was a programmer. So I'd been doing all kinds of technical stuff from a young age. I had a photography background, video. They said, well, you know what? I've been freelancing for over half my life. I'm going to make a company that does nothing but this and prides quality freelancers. So I kind of got the ball rolling on that. And Polymathic came from the fact that it's an adjective for, a Renaissance man of sorts. And I reached out to Joe, one of my partners who went to grad school with me, and he kind of came on board, and we slowly started to build a team because I got lucky that he's also multidisciplinary and very, very proud of that. That's really a big part of our core workforce. So we got to a certain point where we were mostly working with non-technical startup founders. So, we would build for existing businesses, and that was fine. It wasn't really the most exciting work for us personally. But these founders would come to us and be like, I've got this great idea. I'm so excited about it. And I just need someone to help me build it. And as those from Chicago know, there's a little bit of a developer crisis going on here. But we really love ideas more than anything. That's probably the advertising background. So we said, sure, we'll help out. But they were running into the same problems over and over again. And it was really frustrating to watch them run out of money, or they didn't have mentors, or they didn't have any way to really get feedback while they were building. And even though it wasn't really our fault, we kind of felt like there was some way that we could help them and also, help ourselves, because basically building nothing but startups is like a dream job for us. You can't get bored. It's like ADD proof. It's great. So we really, really love it. I mean, it's so amazing to be able to come in and work on multiple things in one day, or spend just, a week doing this, a week doing that. We all kind of take shifts. So Junto was born from that. So Junto is basically an internal startup for building other startups. right now it's kind of mostly a service-based intra company, but we're shooting to create a community that's not unlike Kickstarter in terms of the ecosystem, but the focus will be on feedback, not on funding. We really think that customer development is very important, and if you think of the lean startup methodology, we take some bits from that, and we think that everyone should have access to quality feedback while they're building and kind of promote their process and really get lots of people involved. So we're hoping we can create a whole community that's surrounded around that concept.
Well, let me ask you then, is so if somebody, let's say an established entity, small business, large business, is needing media production, do they then primarily work with Polymathic and what you're able to provide, and then it's more for the startups that the Junto is available, or am I misunderstanding?
Nope, that's exactly it. Polymathic is still, you know, still functioning. We still have some existing companies that we choose to work with, you know, who we really enjoy. We're passionate about what they're doing, and we still can do, you know, web, photo, video, the works for them. And then we pull the various people who work on the Polymathic team, staff the teams that build the startups for Junto. So it actually works out really well. And if you were to graduate from the Junto program, then you can go back into Polymathic and continue to have maintenance done on your startup and commission additional work so that you never have to have an in-house technical team if you don't want to.
That sounds fantastic for anybody thinking about a startup, because then, from my understanding, you know, I'm particularly reading the Junto blog, which is at blog.thejun.to, if I'm pronouncing that right. From what I've read on the blog, the intent is basically, and for what you just said, for somebody that's interested in an idea, they can come to Junto and have a place where people can review the idea and give feedback before that individual invests a lot of time and effort into the particular idea. So they kind of know whether something has public interest or has, you know, get some excitement going before they start throwing resources into it. Is that kind of how that's intended to proceed?
Yeah. So there's kind of, you know, the two processes. I think on the blog right now, it outlines it as the idea gallery and the production gallery. It's going to become a little bit more fluid than that, the way that Junto 2.0 is being built out. But essentially, yes, you know that at some point you're going to have to raise some money, be it through crowdfunding or a loan or, you know, money that you saved up to build a startup. And yes, you should have some sort of indicator of interest before you even put that money and time into it. So we're going to give people a place where they can say, I've got this great idea. I'm set on doing it. What do you think? What could I change? What would I do differently? And really, you know, get where you need to be in order to know that, okay, this is where I'm going to put my life savings, or this is where I'm going to ask all of my friends to give me $25 so I can build this thing, et cetera. It's
right.
Really got to be worth your time and resources. And then once you're actually ready to rumble, we're going to be allowing people to get feedback during the actual production process. And that's whether or not, you know, we might be building the startups, or we're going to allow outside teams that are building startups to also use the various Junto community systems probably toward the end of the month. And you'll also be able to broadcast your budget. And we're going to have ways to kind of sift through demographic data. It's going to be lots of tools just focused on founders really getting what they need.
So when you talk about founders, founders are those individuals starting the startups. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
And in talking earlier, you had mentioned that you were primarily focused, or Polymathic was primarily focused, or its clientele happened to be primarily non-technical founders or companies. So is that going to continue, or maybe, I guess, for the listeners, explain what you mean by non-technical founders versus technical founders or technical startups?
For sure. So I would say, you know, I live in Logan Square, which, you know, has a really great kind of sub-local startup community, you know, designers, developers, UX people. It's great. We all meet really often, and I have a high level of respect for what everyone is doing. And we're all building startups because we already have the, you know, the skill resources to make it happen. So we would be considered, most of us would be considered technical founders. I could say, I have this idea, I'm going to go marathon it for a week and build it myself. In terms of non-technical founders, I would think a good example is a project that's starting this week called Pretty Quick. The founder is Coco Mears. And so she is an MBA student at the Booth School of Business over at UChicago, and She has a ton of experience in the actual industry that she's trying to build a startup for. So we're really big on founders that want to build a startup that's born out of frustration, is usually the way that I put it. So, you know, I worked in this industry for a couple of years, and this one process is just so inefficient, I can't take it anymore. And Coco would be a pretty good, you know, example of that. She thinks that there's definitely a way to make things faster and more enjoyable for consumers with her product. You know, she worked at L'Oreal for a couple of years, and, you know, she's got all of the necessary pieces except for the programmer and design and whatnot. So we kind of fill in the gap, and then we all work together as a team. It's definitely not like whenever someone asks us if you know, someone outsources to us, I really say I don't like that word, because outsourcing is where we say, you know, you go build that thing and then come back when it's done. We're very like morally opposed to that. You know, we want founders to be a part of what we're doing the entire time.
It's a collaborative process.
Definitely.
Which I think would probably you know, make everything more efficient, right? I mean, so many times when somebody, quote-unquote, outsources a project and sends it out and waits for it to come back, you know, a company may send a project to an advertising company, get the campaign idea proposed to them. They may not like it at all, and then the advertising company has spent so much time developing a particular campaign that the client doesn't even like. By collaborating, not only do you avoid that, I would presume to the largest part, but then at the same time, you'd also create the better product because everybody's input keeps going on as it's being developed.
Totally, and coming in really early. I think that's kind of the most important part, and we encourage people to ask questions. So, for instance, you know, Coco might not know a ton about development, but she's worked with, you know, offshore development teams in the past and had a very negative experience, and I encourage her to always look at, you know, our various tasks and conversations in our project management software team box, you know, and ask questions. Say, well, why are you doing something that way, or why are we using this specific technology? Because it's an educational experience. On top of the fact that if she's reading what we're doing and really being a part of it, she's going to make sure that we don't do something that she, you know, that violates her vision, you know, and vice versa. So it works out really well that way.
And then in the end, the you know, what you end up creating or what all of you end up creating, collaborating on, does have her vision, as you just said, which is so important so that when you're going out there, in any kind of industry or creating a personality online, for example, that, you know, that it is you, that it is the company, that something's not being portrayed on behalf of the company that doesn't really fit the personality, I would imagine. So the non-technical, really, so the startups or businesses are coming to you for the technical and the design to come in a collaborative manner, which is fantastic. Now, what I've also read about Polymathic is that it's WordPress-based, or WordPress plays a large role in some design elements. Is that correct?
Yes. So anyone who's a developer who's listening to this might kind of cringe when they hear that initially. So most people think of WordPress as blogging software, which totally makes sense. I mean, a lot of blogs and very, very large sites that are run on it, larger than anyone would ever really guess. But the open source community that surrounds WordPress is really great. It's really, really impressive. It's very active. And so what we do is, you know, we mostly build with PHP. These days, you either see startups built with like PHP, Rails, or Python, I'd say. And so we build, you know, a custom thing with PHP, and then we allow WordPress to kind of be the outer shell, which enables founders, since they're non-technical, to come in and edit their own information and create their own content. So, you know, when they're on their homepage, they can make sure that the copy, you know, is whatever they want it to be. Like, it's still giving them a fair amount of control while not really sacrificing any technical elements at the same time. So it's kind of a best of both worlds, not to mention the amount of plugins and whatnot that are available for WordPress it's amazing. But since we're building very early stage prototypes, you know, some of it is a matter of cobbling existing processes together, because since we don't build proprietary software, we only build web startups. Sometimes, you know, we're saved many, many hours of time by using existing plugins that came from the WordPress community and then extending them with PHP.
Sure. And then the founder doesn't need to be extremely well-versed in Dreamweaver or some other platform of coding themselves. It's basically, if you have, you know, based on my own experience, just an understanding of the WordPress environment, that gives them the ability to manage some of the content on their site.
For sure. Yes,
and
definitely.
And I, you know, coming from my own business perspective, I think is for a startup, for any small business, very key to have that kind of control over the content so that you can make changes and that you're not reliant for any number of reasons on, and nothing against Polymathic or Junto, but you're not reliant on the company that you've hired to create the design elements to manage the content for you on a daily basis. You may want that, but at the same time, it's nice to have access to one's own content and material and be able to tweak it. Because as you know, I mean, running a small business in this day and age, you constantly are wanting to update things and manage the content. So how has Junto been growing? I mean, how has it been going for you and the founders that have used it? Or are you still in the kind of startup phase of your internal startup?
I would say, yeah, you know, we're still pretty early. We started building Junto in May of last year, and we put out a couple of alphas, and then we launched a public beta in October at Technori Pitch event, if anyone is familiar with that. And then we've tried to put out new iterations every 2 to 3 months. So this one that's supposed to be coming out at the end of this month, early July, is definitely like a very appropriate pivot for us. You know, we've got the two projects that are publicly, they're actually ready to go. They're being announced tomorrow on Tuesday for people to go in and play with. So that would be SmashUp and Nomadate. And then we've got a couple more in the queue, including Coco's pretty quick, and a project called Focal Point that's for filmmakers, and a couple of other really, really fun stuff coming up. But, you know, there's only so much that we can scale our workflow. So we've been going out of our way to, you know, make sure we only take on what we can actually manage, and we've had to hire and all that. So I would say that we're, you know, we're growing, hopefully not too rapidly. You know, my dream is to have little, you know, distributed teams all over the U.S. I'm very passionate about hiring within the U.S. and not outsourcing at all. Particularly, we try to only hire in Illinois and Wisconsin, since that's where all of our people are right now, and it's a way for us to give back to the Midwestern, you know, economy and workforce. But ideally, if we could have little teams all over the place, then we can say, all right, well, this team specializes in hybrid apps. So this particular startup is going to be funneled through this team and with this project manager. So it allows us to kind of scale without being location dependent and, you know, bring in a lot of really quality people from all around the country.
You mentioned a couple of things that I'd like to hit on that are really great and something to talk about. One, the fact that you try to, at this point, hire from Illinois and Wisconsin and stay local in that respect, but obviously with expansion within the United States later. But also talking about growing your team, and a few people that have been on Startup Radio have commented about the importance of team and team dynamics and the importance of, you know, being able to work well with the individuals on a team. So if you don't mind me asking, you know, how many people do you have on your team at this time?
Well, we have, you know, as I mentioned, a distributed team. So right now there is me, Matt, and Joe. We're the core staff. I mean, we're the owners. And then we've got Dan, our lead engineer, and we've taken on a couple of other contractors. So you know, our team can kind of flex depending on what our actual needs are. And for instance, if Polymathic has a project that has a lot of video, then we're obviously going to bring on different people for that, you know, so there'd be a crew involved. So we could, you know, be evolving from anywhere from, I guess, 4 to 20 people, depending on what it is. We're trying to keep it kind of under 10 for the web projects in particular, since I would say that, yes, there's a certain cultural fit that's involved. You know, people are often talking about company culture, and for us, it's sort of a mixture of sense of humor and accountability. And one of the things about working with other Midwesterners is that we all kind of feel like we relate to each other, and it's very easy for us to get along. And you know, so it's always been very pleasant. And we just kind of know, we meet someone, we say, okay, that is the person that we want to work with. So, you know, it's kind of like meeting a husband or a wife or something, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a very good point, because when you consider oftentimes how much time you spend with the people that you share an office with or collaborate with, it can have the significance of that kind of relationship, and not only the time, but the seriousness of the issues, and you've got to get along. Now, another thing that you mentioned there is the Midwestern background, also talking about locally here. You're very big in the Chicago startup community. How would you describe the Chicago startup community? Do you think it has its own culture as opposed to, let's say, you know, Silicon Valley or New York City, for example?
I do. I mean, I did go to school in New York, but I wasn't a part of the startup team when I was there, and I haven't spent enough time in San Francisco to really have a ton of input on how it's different per se, other than, you know, what we all hear via articles and my friends that have moved out to San Francisco, because there are certainly people who leave Chicago for San Francisco because it's a better fit for them. And I would say that's because San Francisco, you know, there's a lot of money there. It's very product driven, whereas we definitely get some flack in Chicago for being revenue model driven to a certain degree, which I mean, personally, I don't really see anything wrong with that.
Right.
Our culture here has evolved heavily in the past, like a year and a half, you know, with Technori and everything like that. It's a lot more collaborative than it used to be, which is really awesome. And, you know, we're seeing more incubation spaces pop up in 1871 and Merchandise Mart and all that to kind of get our startup mecca going. And I feel like we're all we really talk to each other all the time, and maybe it's a little bit more sensible. And there's also the fact that we tend to build very practical startups. I'm a huge fan of that. So I really love where the scene is going. You know, the reason I bought property here is because this is the scene that I want to be a part of, you know, for the foreseeable future. And I've loved watching it evolve. It's really great, you know, from even the small events. So like I will throw like a brunch or a potluck dinner or something. I had this one potluck dinner that was all startup design and tech people that was like 40 people at this huge Franken table that we built in my old place. And, you know, it's such an amazing thing that we can all just sit there and talk about stuff. And I'm going to be starting a new group for founders here, for female founders, a way for them all to hang out in a different kind of way. And yeah, I love where it's going. You know, I go to a Technori event and I'm just all smiles the whole time. Fantastic.
Sure. Well, I imagine that the conversations at your dinner party must have been fascinating. And now with this endeavor, tell me a little bit more about the endeavor with female founders. When is that going to be taking place, or what prompted you to do that?
Well, we'll call this, I guess this is a little bit of an announcement, because I have just been talking about this publicly recently. So a friend of mine, Annie Pastanese, who runs Hungry Entrepreneurs, we were thinking about how female entrepreneurs interact. And, you know, there are some women in tech groups here, but it's really not, they're very networking based. And I said, well, you know, the way that I met the startup people here, this is how it happened. I will tell you this story, because this is a fascinating story. I went on an internet blind date with a kid named Chris Wilkinson, who's really, really awesome. He's really sweet. We wound up being friends. And he introduced me to someone named Brandon Weiss, who's since moved to San Francisco. But he introduced me to a whole bunch of people at his launch party for his startup and subsequent, you know, parties and events. And I grew to know all these really great people and respect them based on their personality and their work ethic, and not so much what they were building at that particular time. So it was almost like networking was a byproduct. So I thought about that and I said, well, I really know there are more women who are building things in the city, and I would rather get to know them in a different way. So it's called the Hustle Sisters, is what we're calling it, and it is all events that get people away from their computer. So we're going to be throwing a founder vaudeville event where all the women are going to do something performative. We're going to do a founder camp trip where we're all going to go out and kayak and stay out in the wilderness for a couple of days. It's going to be woodworking 101. Some like Arduino hacking, like very cool hands-on stuff that just isn't in front of the computer. And when I get to know someone you know, that way, you know, falling over in a kayak and everyone laughing and making a fool of themselves, I feel like I'm going to get a better feel for who I would want to work with in the future and who kind of fits my personal morals that go along with building startups. So that's where things are going to head. It's a little slow going, but I think it's going to be a really nice alternative to what's out there. It's intended to complement what's out there, because certainly there's a place for traditional networking events. I mean, they exist for a reason, but I feel like it would be more inviting to have female founders kind of get together in a different way as well.
Sure. And talking about women and female founders, that, you know, one of our guests recently was Terry Steinbeck, who's starting Digital Divas, and that particular program, her intent is to reach out to the grade schools and try to get young girls interested in technology, not in the use or the consumerism of it, but actually to create technology and get in the hands-on, you know, whether it's the Lego blocks or robot Legos and so forth. But because there needs to be, from her perspective, and I agree, more women role models that are involved in technology and even in startups, and now, you know, as you suggested and are starting a networking event or networking group for that very kind of bringing people together. And I agree, whether it's women, men, what have you, taking people outside the context of the formal networking event is so beneficial, because you really do begin to learn more about who the people are. As you said, you know, laughing with someone as you fall outside of a kayak, which I'd probably end up doing if it were myself. But I think that's great that you're helping to, you know, fit that into your plans and making that a part of what's happening here in Chicago. Now, let me go back to another comment that you made. You talked about how Chicago has practical startups. What do you mean by that, or that we have more of a practical in Chicago, a practical sense?
All right, let's see. As an example, okay, so I mentioned how San Francisco is rather product-driven. I feel like when I use the phrase here, born out of frustration, an example, gosh, of course, now I'm blanking on the name of what it's actually called. Oh, Spot Hero. There we go. So there is a startup here called Spot Hero that finds parking spaces ahead of time. So I can say, I'm going to go down the loop. I need somewhere to park, and know that I'm going to have somewhere to park. And they can do it, you know, over by Wrigley or all kinds of congested places. And they've got this great system for it. And it's very forward thinking, but really solves a genuine problem. You know, people have a hard time finding parking in Chicago. That's a real thing. It's very practical. You're making people's lives easier. Whereas some of the stuff that comes out of San Francisco, you know, I could do without Twitter personally. I've definitely found needs for it that have like changed my life. But at the same time, you know, Twitter was kind of, it's a cool thing that makes some stuff more fun. It's not necessarily making life easier per se. That might not be the best example, but that's kind of where we're coming from. That's probably why there's a lot of meta startups of sorts in Chicago too that help other startups, not unlike Junto.
Well, and another aspect of what you were talking about earlier that I think that Junto 2.0 is starting to or will incorporate is crowdfunding, somewhat similar, I think you mentioned, to Kickstarter. How significant do you think crowdfunding is to a startup community or a founder in getting a project off the ground?
Well, it's kind of a loaded question because, you know, there's the whole Jobs Act thing that passed and people are excited about equity plays and all that, and I get it. But I think about Kickstarter. You know, I have a friend who his project was one of the first like successful projects at Kickstarter when it first started, and we're all really kind of into what Kickstarter can do for physical products here. Like a friend of mine that started Cards Against Humanity, this one card game that really blew up because of its Kickstarter project. And I think there's a lot of really great stuff happening there. And when I had mentioned the Kickstarter ecosystem earlier, I mean, the thing that's important to me is, you know, if you take Cards Against Humanity, for example, there are people who did not know Max, one of the founders of it, and gave him money because they were so into what he was doing. So if you have strangers giving other strangers money and time and kindness, you know, how can we use that in other ways? So that's why we're trying to create, you know, that ecosystem for feedback, because you can get strangers kind of interacting. But crowdfunding itself, I do think it's important. Kickstarter, that model is really suited for a per project basis. They don't want people starting companies there, and I think that that's good that they're making that call. But then, you know, startups need a place to call home for doing their own crowdfunding, and there's various stuff popping up. But when it comes to normal crowdfunding versus equity crowdfunding, I personally am not actually a fan of the equity crowdfunding thing that's going to happen. For some people, it might be a good fit, but personally, I think that if a startup is, you know, I'm a founder and I'm going to get $20 from all of my friends and hopefully kind strangers to build my dream startup, it's much better for me to start on the right foot of I have this money and I don't owe anyone anything. That's one
right.
of the, you know, big pluses of crowdfunding, especially with Kickstarter. You know, people are getting to kind of, because debt is such a scary thing. Whereas with equity and convertible debt and all this kind of stuff, I mean, people are just getting into these messes and they shouldn't have to give up equity for a small amount of money. That's just my personal belief on that. I think there might be some instances where someone's going to change my mind. But we personally don't really want to offer that just yet. We want to have crowdfunding be kind of part of a larger picture. So, yes, it's something we already have built, and we're going to let people use it. But it's really intended to be something that feeds back into the feedback system. So I actually mean to say it like that. But, you know, I give someone $25 and then I'm an early adopter and I'm really like weighing in on this product while they're building it. And I'm getting small perks here and there. And maybe the rewards are contingent on the person's business model. So I give them $25 and I get a year free membership or whatever it is that they're building, et cetera. So
right.
there's ways to really have it be more of a cyclical integrated process as opposed to Kickstarter is really great at what it's already doing with the physical products. So hopefully we can find a way to kind of marry that and allow everyone to have that same kind of ecosystem, but for web-based startups.
Well, I'll be excited to see that develop and move into the future, as with all of the features that you're talking about. I think that what you're providing with Junto is going to be fantastic for founders and people to get a firm start. And I would agree with you too that, you know, the equity crowdfunding is, you know, with somebody starting a business, you know, that's going to just add so many complications onto something where their focus oftentimes should be on the idea and developing the idea and not having to worry about you know, owing people or having equity issues at that point in time. That can always come down the line, but it's hard to go backwards once you've started to establish equity in a particular entity and so forth. What do you find, what advice do you have for, you know, founders or people that are wanting to engage in the startup community? What have you found some of the things that are there consistent mistakes that many people make that you found?
In Chicago in particular or just generally?
Just generally.
Oh, gosh. Well, I've been writing this whole series of essays that I've been meaning to publish kind of talking about startup morale. And I think a big thing that I noticed because, well, to take a step back, we crowdfunded $10,000 for Junto last summer. And that, you know, between that and the client work we were doing got us through a summer of trying to build Junto out. And, you know, we all had to be frugal. There were three people whose rent needed to be paid and all that good stuff. And I wish it had I thought about it, because I definitely, you know, as my co-founders would tell you, I'm very eager and they're always trying me to vet my millions of ideas. But I was like, oh, you know, I wrote a 19-page PDF manifesto and that's like where Junto came from because I was so frustrated. And I said, we can really help these people. But if I had put that down and then slept on it and then thought about how, well, you know, I should save up X amount of money, you know, to make sure that my rent is going to be paid for this amount of time and I'm going to have this much money just in case and all that. And I hate to put such an emphasis on money, but I think that there's, you know, I've never really had to panic like that. Like I definitely had moments where we were building a startup and I'm like, oh no, I don't know. I'm going to pay my rent. My parents are so mad at me and you know, all this kind of stuff. And maybe part of it is growing up. I'm at this point now where it might've only been a year, but I feel like I learned 5 years worth of stuff. And I just wish that I had understood how worrying about things was going to affect morale so much. I mean, we had times where all three of us were like really freaking out about stuff. And then you can't really be productive. You can't be your most creative if you're
right.
you know, really, really worried. So whether it's saving up money or it's making sure that you've tied off some loose ends or something, I think that that is really important. And really doing your research. I'm thinking about some of our founders that we know that have had to like pivot a lot, people that we worked with pre-Junto. But do your research, get data, talk to people. Just talk to people all the time about your idea and it really kind of write down all that feedback and keep track of what's out there. And don't let small amounts of data influence you either. Because, you know, if you go to like a Lean Startup Machine event, you need to know you have to hit critical mass to have that data have relevance. If you talk to, you know, your mom's friend, you know, who's 65 and says, oh, well, I don't like that idea and it does, you know, this, and that's bad, that's stupid. But she's not part of your target market, but you pay attention to her anyway, then that's going to, you know, kind of screw up what you're doing. That said, if she were part of your target market, but everyone else was overjoyed and their feedback was totally different, you know, you just got to kind of take stuff with a grain of salt and really
right.
The critical mass point is very important.
Well, when I was going to law school, a classic example that I use with taking advice or comments, not necessarily advice, but comments or feedback in context is I mentioned to somebody that I was attending law school and their response was, don't you think that we have enough lawyers out in the world that we really don't need anymore? And I said, well, you know, putting that aside, I know that we don't have enough good lawyers, and so that's what I plan on being. But, I mean, if you listen to every comment, whether it was tended to be negative or not, you can get disheartened and may misdirect you. But as you just said, I mean, I think that it's important to – I would agree that it's important to take comments and feedback and consider it. But certainly if somebody doesn't like a product that's coming from a target area that's completely outside of what you're intending to do, then their input really shouldn't mean that much at all and not to get disheartened by that. And, you know, I think that that's oftentimes where people have, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that people do have a misperception of the startup scene generally, or starting a small business generally, that, wow, it would be great to have your own business, to, you know, set your own hours and so forth. But the reality is, while there are certainly advantages, and I love having my own firm and working with the team that I have, there are day-to-day challenges, and it just creates, you know, there are a whole set of other problems that you wouldn't have to worry about otherwise. I mean, there are, as you said, days where, you know, you're thinking about the bills that need to be paid. There's collectible issues from customers and clients and so forth. So it's not all green pastures. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. It's tough. I hear people talking about the entrepreneurial lifestyle, and I was just debating this with someone the other day. You know, they'll go to something like a Lean Startup Machine event, which I have mentored at three of them now, you know, and they talk about the whole setting their own hours and having all that freedom, and that's great, and that's certainly part of what works for me. You know, the 9-to-5 lifestyle was not a good fit for me. But there's definitely, you know, you have to be ready to take a lot of risk, and you have to be ready to adapt to so many varying conditions, and yeah, people really need to examine what goes into it. You know, I heard someone say something to the effect of, don't just be excited about having a C-level title attached to your name and being able to tell people that you're a CEO, all that kind of stuff. In the end, like, that doesn't really matter. Someone, one of my friends was like, well, Marcy, you're a CEO now, when I complained about something. And I said, yeah, but I'm really just a person trying to, you know, make my way in the world and build something that's important to me and survive in the end. So whether I'm, you know, a CEO or a project manager or just, you know, a freelancer or whatever, there's still a lot of struggles that come with that people need to keep in mind.
So don't quit one's day job until one's really considered all of the ins and outs and making sure that they're on board for jumping into the startup or the entrepreneurial culture. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, sometimes I think people stay in their day job too long and it kind of is detrimental to their startup process. There's like a happy medium in between there, I would say. because sometimes people will just keep working because it, you know, if you have a family, I think it's different. You know, some of us that are on the younger end that don't, you know, aren't married and don't have kids yet, there's a lot more risk that we can take. But that kind of the happy medium is going to be different for everyone. But I would say that everything that's startup related takes 2 to 3 times longer than you think it's going to. So if I think about Junto last year, and if I had planned for it to be two or three times longer than it did to take to build the first iteration, and I had planned financially accordingly, you know, I would have, my morale would have stayed more level the whole time. You know, if I had said, okay, well, I think this is going to take 2 months, but it's really going to take 6.
Sure.
I've
heard that consistently from people that, you know, it's like construction work on your home. You know, you get a quote that, oh yeah, it'll be done in a month. Or particularly as you and I were talking before offline, if you're doing it yourself, it's going to probably take a bit longer than if you hire someone. But it's always going to take longer than what you think or what you budget for. And I, just to add to your comment that it's somewhere in between, I'd have to agree with that because of my own instance of starting my law firm. You know, that was 2001. My wife and I moved from Connecticut to Chicago just before 9/11, neither one of us having jobs at the other end, but clearly with the intent, my intent was just to start with a law firm similar to that which I worked with in Connecticut, but it didn't happen. And that situation kind of prompted me to create my own firm and just stay busy. And in the end, it led to where I am today, right? But if I hadn't been forced into that situation, I don't know that I would have taken the leap to say, hey, let me start my own law firm and see where it goes. So I would add that, you know, a lot of times it's recognizing when an opportunity, whether forced upon one or coming upon one by happenstance, that if you keep your eyes open, those opportunities are there. Because I'm a big advocate of small businesses and startups. One of my good friends and one of the first clients that I had, Jimmy Allen, was a photographer working for a newspaper when I first met him back in 2002, and he started his own photography business, and it's just grown phenomenally. So I think you're right. It's that in between, it's a balance. As long as you you know, have an idea of what you're doing, but it's also a combination of taking that risk. But before we move to some questions, because we are running out of time, and I know that you've taken some precious time to be with us here today, so to kind of summarize, if there are small businesses, small, medium, large businesses that are looking for a collaborative group, a collaborative team to work with on the tech and the design side, then Polymathic may be for them. Is that correct?
Yep.
And then if somebody is a founder or thinking about being a founder of a startup, an idea, then Junto provides the opportunity for them to explore that in a graduated kind of environment where you provide the tools and the mechanisms, which will continue, it sounds like, to expand over time, but that they can get feedback and somewhat grow their ideas, see where that growth grows organically, and eventually if it does take off, then they too can merge into becoming a client of Polymathic. Did I get that right as well?
Yeah, I think that's the best I've ever heard anyone put it.
Well, I don't know about that, but I appreciate the comment. So if somebody needs to get in touch with Junto, as I described it, or Polymathic, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, if they are an existing business and they're looking to work with Polymathic, it's probably best to just email me because I tend to vet through the project. So that would be marcy@polymathic.me, polymathic.me. As for Junto, if you go on the site, there is a link to an application of sorts. I recommend that anyone who's looking to build a startup kind of take a look at that. It's based off of the Lean Canvas to some degree, and really be thinking about your problem and your solution and what you can bring to the table. And if you find that you can fill it out and you want to see if maybe building with us would be a good fit, then just submit that. But feel free to send me an email to, you know, let me know that it's coming, and we'll, it usually takes us about a week to process applications. It's been a little bit longer lately, just because we've been kind of slammed, but we do shoot for somewhere between 3 and 7 days.
Great. Well, let's turn to some of the individuals that are listening live. One of our first callers is Mark. Mark, do you have any questions for us?
Yes, I was intrigued by the comment that, you know, San Francisco is a product-driven market while the startups here in Chicago are revenue-driven. Do you think that will be – how do you think that will affect Chicago's outlook as a startup market in the years to come? Do you think it will be advantageous to have that model, or do you think it will be have some other effects to Chicago?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know if anyone who's listening read the Pando Daily article that was about, you know, the Midwestern mentality, I think was what Trevor called it. And Trevor was actually staying with me while he wrote that, which was strange because I had no idea that, you know, he was going to kind of knock on the Midwestern lifestyle. But I think that it just suits us really well. I mean, it's when you build a revenue-focused startup, you're taking risk, but, you know, to borrow – the word graduated a little bit. And I feel like it's just more of a practical risk. The whole, you know, San Francisco is super expensive to live in. You know, I have friends who are now paying 3 times as much as my old rent for half the size of where I used to live, you know, and so the cost of living is higher. I would say the risk is higher. In terms of being advantageous here in Chicago, yeah, I think that we're a very supportive community. We're all sticking around. I just think there's a lot of, I don't know, longevity here. I feel like my friends that have moved to San Francisco, as much as I love them, there's maybe a little bit of a flighty, adventure-seeking sort of thing going on there, whereas people who are here are like, I am going to sit down and like, I'm ready to roll. Like, I want to be focused, and I want this, you know, the whole lifestyle business kind of thing is very big here. I don't know if that totally answers your question, though.
I think so, and maybe one follow-up on that. Have you seen people, an exodus from San Francisco to Chicago in their startups, or is that too early to tell?
Sorry, can you say that one more time?
Have you seen an exodus of startups moving from San Francisco to Chicago?
Oh, you know, I've heard that there are a couple that have been coming over here. The last Lean Startup Machine that I worked at, though, there was this really great team. Their startup is called Dovetail, and it's like a social network for creatives of sorts, and it's a project that's very near and dear to my heart. I think it's extremely useful, and it is, you know, born of frustration. And even though they were all kind of from the West Coast, they decided that they wanted to come here because it was the appropriate place for them to build something that people really needed. I think, feel like that's probably the biggest impetus, is that word of people really needing what it is that's happening. They are going to make so many of the people's lives easier, like the professional lives, that it's just amazing.
And that goes back to practical, right?
Yep, definitely.
Go ahead.
I love how practical everything here is. I mean, I was raised by parents who were always preaching, you know, we always had practical gifts, you know, even like you get underwear for Christmas or something. It sounds like a strange thing to bring up, but I think that it's important because they were always giving me things to help me further in my life. You know, like when I was a photographer, my parents were giving me small amounts of stuff to supplement my photography equipment and all that, and they really just wanted to give me tools to better my life, and I feel like that's just such a big part of our culture here.
Now, do you still do your own, do you still do photography on the side?
Oh, gosh. I do, but not as much as I used to. Occasionally, I'll do some shooting or some video stuff. I use the same camera for photo and video, you know, for Polymathic, but it depends. It's tough. I think that's maybe more of a fine art thing for me personally. I can definitely, you know, creative direct projects to that end for commercial applications and bring in photographers and video people that I think are appropriate. But my own personal use of it is almost always going to be like a personal expression kind of thing. So I do hope to get back to that eventually, considering I'm sitting in my office right now and staring at how much of my equipment I've got piled up. So hopefully one day.
Well, and I hope you don't mind me mentioning that a portfolio of some of your photographs are on your own site at marcycapron.com.
Yeah, and can you believe some of those are from, like, you know, eighth grade and ninth grade. That's
no kidding.
Yep.
That's amazing.
Crazy imagination.
Well, I think we have time. If you have time, we have time for one more question. This is Trisha.
Hi there. Hi, Marcy. You mentioned earlier you mentioned earlier that you had some of those moments where you were just sitting there and you weren't sure exactly how it was going to pan out, or, you know, you had those worrisome moments. And coming from a Midwestern background, I can kind of understand how that might be a little bit harder than if you would have maybe grown up in maybe a different part of the country. Can you maybe give me some tips on how you kind of worked your way through that, or some maybe coping mechanisms perhaps?
Sure. I can give you some that are probably based on my biggest regrets. I didn't take a roommate, and I should have, because my cost of living would have gone down so substantially had I done that. Another thing is, I don't know if you know what Airbnb is, which is actually, I think it's a San Francisco company, but the average person in New York City who rents out either an extra room or their own bed or a sofa in their living room, whatever. There's one lady, I think it was the founder of Recycled Bride, who made $27,000. Some odd, or maybe I think it's $27,000 a year on average for the New York person who rents stuff out. And then she made like 40 some odd thousand dollars for her startup from renting out every inch of space in her apartment, because there are always people coming to New York and needing somewhere to stay. I would say that in Chicago and other larger Midwestern cities like Milwaukee and Madison, that there's definitely a market for that as well. If you have the space to give someone a nice air bed, I mean, I think that it could definitely help you pay your rent. I think the biggest thing is, you know, rent, insurance, and food. one of the things that I experienced is I went from, I made a fair amount of money as a photographer, and then reverting to the startup lifestyle, that there were things that I had considered necessities for a decade that I suddenly found myself being like, wow, I actually really don't need those. So if you can just sit down and think about it, even if it's, you know, I'm going to drink this coffee instead of this one because it costs half the price, or I'm going to choose to only go out once a week, or I'm going to sell my car and get a Zipcar membership, you know, things like that. Just trying to take stuff that you feel like you need and seeing where you can kind of pare it down. So taking the lean startup attitude and kind of applying it to the rest of your life.
Thank you.
So feel free to email me.
Yeah,
I hope so.
Great.
Well, Marcy, I want to thank you again. It's been great having you on Startup Radio, and not only was that great advice in response to Trisha's question, but great advice generally and things for founders to think about as they move forward. So, again, thanks for being on Startup Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And seriously, if anyone wants to reach out, I'm always down to answer questions. It might take me a couple days, but I love to be helpful when I can.
Well, that brings the conclusion of today's Startup Radio. On June 18th, we will have as a guest Chris Campbell of Startup Weekend, and June 25th, Bettina Hine of Pixabilly, Inc. I wish you all well, have a great afternoon, and we'll see you next week.